You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
We're talking about the mysterious today, I guess ghosts and apparitions, and a high interest topic, I guess, everywhere. With me is someone who's an authority on it. Her name is Barbara Sillery, born in New York, had the wisdom at some point to move to New Orleans, live in New Orleans for a while. Now she's in Cape Cod. And I tell you, between New Orleans and Cape Cod, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of ghost stories there between the two. Let me begin by asking you, I guess these are the kind of questions everybody asks you, but I just need to know it to establish myself psychologically here. What do you believe in?
I believe that we can connect with our past. It's sort of like having a sixth sense. You're more aware of things that have gone before. And I know that there are some people I interviewed, the Archbishop of the Israelite Black Spiritual Church. And he told me once that if you pray hard enough, you can see spirits and you can talk to them. So, and I just finished a conference in Groveland, Massachusetts. It was called Spirit Quest. I'd never been around a group of people where everyone there were true believers, felt, you know, they were the kind that were the private paranormal investigators. They went out looking for ghosts. That's not really something that I do. I like to do the history and the research. And when I first started doing a documentary, The Haunting of Louisiana, which was my first book was based on, I had to come up with three criteria because a PBS documentary is only 56 minutes and 40 seconds. And I had too many ghosts. So, you know, between plantations that we have an abundance of in Louisiana, and there's a saying that in every old plantation has to have at least one ghost or hang its head in shame. And then, of course, you have New Orleans, Ghost Central, USA. So I came up with a criteria that if a ghost was going to be, or his story or her story was going to be in one of my books, they had to meet three criteria. They had to be based on a real person. They had to be connected to a historic site. And the tale had to be connected or at least been told in the community for at least 100 years. Because I needed something to do for the research. I wanted to be able to tell the full story. How did the story get started? How did it change over time? So I have kind of maybe a little different approach than the paranormal investigators do. I'm not necessarily out to go find them as I am to find out about them and why the story got started.
So a real person, they have to be a real person, an historic site, with a story that's at least 100 years old.
Right.
So, but what is it? Here's where I get confused. What is it that people are looking for when they say ghost? Are they looking for an apparition of a human being, or are they looking for some kind of sight out there or an orb? Or, I mean, what defines a ghost?
Most people are looking to make a connection. You know, for a lot of people, it's their loved one has died and they'd like to know that they're happy and that they're okay, and that when there are special events in their life, that this loved one, this person that has passed, is aware of them, that this connection is still made. And that's what I like to tell people, that I think ghost stories are important because they reflect our culture and our traditions, and they bring the past alive, and they remind us of the people who came before. That's what I like about ghost stories.
So is there, lack of a better term, a lifespan to a ghost, like a person who died 2,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago, would they still likely be making connection, or are the links to people who knew them just too far away by then?
I couldn't say that with absolute certainty, but I think so long as you, let's say you have a loved one that's died, so long as you think of them, you keep them in your heart, they live on. And yes, I think some stories disappear, just the way some stories in history, we don't, there are lots of things in history that have gone on that we know nothing about. And, you know, through archaeology, through all different kinds of humanities, we start to uncover some of those stories. So yes, I think a ghost story can get lost. Knowledge of a particular person can get lost for hundreds of years. And then someone reads something or finds something. And then in that sense, the spirit does come alive again.
What is connecting to one when you say the spirit comes alive again? Where was the spirit during all this time?
Again, couldn't say without absolute certainty. But I just believe that they're always there. And it's just once you become aware of them, their story, and that's what's so great when you go to like a historic house or a historic museum, and you start to delve into the history of that place. And then you learn about the people who live there or who visited there or something who happened to them there. So, yes, very much in that sense, they live on.
So if somebody goes to plantation houses and they say they see a ghost of the lady of the plantation, right? Wouldn't necessarily have been anybody that she knew, and so that wouldn't likely be a ghost. And also the other thing I wonder about ghosts, like you see them in the lady of plantations wearing an evening dress, or Civil War generals wearing Confederate uniform. How do they get clothes like that?
Well, I was, for example, in when I did the Haunted Louisiana book, I added some new stories from the original book, and one was Homer's House, and I know you're familiar with Homer's House. And people have said that when you start to do a renovation at an older home, you kind of disturb the spirits. And so at Homer's House, which I had never heard before, I'd been around Homer's House for quite a while, was aware of it under the previous owners. Helene Crozet, now it's Kevin Kelly. And shortly after Kevin Kelly took possession, they said that the workers who were doing renovations were complaining that there was a little girl on site and they were worried that, you know, she might get hurt while they were doing all these tools. And Kevin said to them, well, we don't have a little girl here. There's no little girl here. But they persisted in saying they saw her. So he had what they call a séance. And he brought in somebody who said this person said she connected with the little girl. And the little girl told them that she was afraid of Kevin Kelly, the owner, because he was a bigger man, but that she would love for him to come out and play hide and seek with her.
Wow.
So, and then they found in doing the research on the family, one of the families that lived at Homer's house was the Prestons. And they found, and this was about 1840, the Prestons had a little girl by the name of May, who died of yellow fever when she was 8 years old. And then, you know, they've done a lot of, at Homer's house, a lot of trying to bring back the artifacts, the original artifacts of the house. And they found a doll dress. And on the inside of the doll dress, there was a little label that said belonged to May Preston. So they're pretty sure they know that there was such a little girl who did live in this house.
Okay, so when they saw this little girl, I assume she was wearing a dress or something. So do you essentially have ghost dresses? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, now some people will describe a ghost with, you know, with clothes from that period, that's what they see. They see the spirit or the ghost as it would have been during its era, not as it would have been today. So that's what they picture. There's a ghost on the Cape, a sea captain. And people say that when they go to the cemetery where it's his family tomb is, they know it's him because he always had this sort of very long, you know, the handlebar mustache. So when they would see this figure near there, they said they could recognize him because he looked just like his portrait.
Now, when you said they did a seance at home in South of the Florida Girl, how does that work? Is it one person that does that? Is it a group of people? And are they able to actually talk to each other?
Well, now I've never claimed to be able to do that, but there are some people, like I went to this conference this weekend, Spirit Quest, and they had the Ouija boards and everything. And, everybody puts their fingers on it, and one person claims to make a connection and talk and ask questions, like yes or no questions, to try and find out who or which spirit they've connected to.
All right. And so it's yes or no type questions.
It's usually yes or no type questions. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But like,
so
when
like
when this little girl said she liked to play hide and seek with Kevin Kelly, I mean, that's pretty. Mm-hmm.
That was very specific. But that's what the medium who was there was telling Kevin. Now, Kevin says he's never seen anything. And there supposedly are two adult males who are there. And Kevin likes to joke, and I love people that have a sense of humor about it all. And he said, every night I fix three drinks, two for myself, one for myself and two for my male ghosts that are here. He said, but unfortunately, every night I have to drink all three of them.
So what is an orb?
An orb, I guess a kind of a problem with it, because to me, when you take a flash camera picture, there's like a reflection.
Yeah.
But there are people who believe that if you see these like circular shapes, orbs, that means that there is a spirit in the area. But I don't do like urban legends because, pardon the pun, there's not enough substance there for me to do any research. So when people talk about orbs, I'm just kind of like, there's nothing I can do with that. There's no story there that I can follow up on. There's no way of checking anything. So I'm not a big fan of orbs.
So an orb could be nothing more than a badly taken photograph.
I think so. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of other people who disagree with me, and they claim when they take a picture and there are these sort of vague balls of light in the back of the picture, those are orbs, and those represent that a spirit is in the area.
Mm-hmm. Now, people, talk about ghosts. A lot of people are scared of ghosts. Is there any reason to be scared of them?
Years ago, I interviewed Maida Owens, who was the director of folklife for the state of Louisiana. And she said our perception of ghosts and haunted tales has changed over time. And ghosts were always spoken of as something scary that would jump out at you, the rattling of the chains. And she said she feels that has evolved over time. Most people think of ghosts or spirits as a good memory, and they're not usually frightened by them. They might be startled if they come around a corner and they're walking in a historic house and something sort of passes in front of them, but they're not. I've really, in recent times, I really haven't heard anyone say, I'm just really scared. Might be shocked, but not scared. So I think it's just a perception.
We're talking to Barbara Silrey, who has written three books about hauntings, one in Louisiana, one about Louisiana, one about Mississippi, and the other about Cape Cod. She lived in New Orleans for a while, and now she's living in Cape Cod and talking to us from Cape Cod. Well, look, the three areas that you've looked at, let me ask you about each one. Can you tell me a story from each place that you really kind of believe in? Like Louisiana, what's your best call? What's your best story?
I have two favorites in Louisiana. One is a little girl at the Lafitte Guest House, which is right next to Lafitte's blacksmith shop. And right next to Lafitte's blacksmith shop in the French Quarter.
This would be in the French Quarter. Right.
You're right. So it's a three-story, it used to be a townhouse. And they say that there's a little girl there who's trapped in the mirror. And so I thought, oh, well, this will be a perfect one to do when I was doing the documentary. We'll do a little recreation. So I cast this little girl who was 5 years old. Her name was Cedar. Parents are Native American. And I knew Cedar. And so all we told her was that we were going to take her upstairs. And all I needed her to do was walk down the hall and go past the mirror. No one said anything to this child about the ghost story, hauntings, ghost being there. We told her nothing. And she was, we could hear her downstairs. She was happy. She was laughing. We brought her upstairs, stood her in the hall and said, okay, Cedar, anytime, just walk down the hall, go past the mirror. That's it. That's all we need you to do. She wouldn't move. She wouldn't move. She wouldn't move. And I looked down at her and there's tears coming down her face. Finally, her father, Greyhawk, said to her, well, I'll go down past the mirror and I'll wait down there for her with my arms open. And then I'll call to her and she'll come. So we had one shot at it. And so he called Cedar and she's still crying. And she goes down the hall, goes into the arms of her father. He takes her downstairs and we wrapped up the equipment. I went back downstairs and I said to Greyhawk, well, why was she crying? What was going on? And he said he asked her that afterwards. And she said she was crying because she was sad. There was a little girl trapped in the mirror. And we had never said a word to her. Nothing. She knew nothing about. We just told her we were going to put her on camera and have her walk. So wow. That was one of anytime to me you have a story involving a child, either a child ghost or young children that say that they see something that you can't see, I find those stories particularly touching and believable because the owner of the Myrtles Plantation in St. Francisville, her two boys, they had only been there a week. She had told the staff, do not say anything to them about the ghosts of the slave Chloe or the two children who were poisoned here. And she said she had her little one on the bed and she was changing it. And he kept pointing up to the chandelier and he kept saying there was a little girl trapped up there. And she asked him what he wanted her to do. And he wanted her to get the little girl down from the mirror. So she talked to Catherine Kubler-Ross, who wrote the book on death and dying. And what she said to the owner of the plantation is that children under the age of 7 can lie. They can be chewing on a cookie and you can say, did you take that cookie? And they can say no. So, but what they can't do is they can't conjure. They can't create something they haven't seen. So she definitely believes that her little boy saw something that she could not see at the plantation.
Wow, okay. And what he thought he saw was a little girl.
Yeah, he saw the little girl and he claimed she was up in the chandelier.
Okay.
And there have been two little girls that were poisoned, supposedly according to folklore, by the slave Chloe, and they died as well as their mother died at the plantation. And then another little girl died at the plantation, I believe, from yellow fever. So there are a number of ghost stories up there, but all seemingly based on the history of the place.
Okay.
And that's what I like to do when I do tell these stories. I will look for original source documents. I'll look for newspaper articles. I will interview very credible people, you know, school principals, museum directors, docents at the museum. So I try and get as many different viewpoints as possible. And there's usually, you know, people do have different views on what's going on there.
Well, I think I know the answer to this, but what do you think about all these, these ghost tours that are in cities now and in all parts of town?
I've gone on some of them. I've gone on some here. I've gone on some in New Orleans, and some are quite good with their history, and some kind of veer off somewhere, and Maida Owens of the Folklife Division of the state of Louisiana would say, there is folklore and there's fake lore. And she said, I don't have a problem with fake lore, so long as you tell the people that you're telling the story for entertainment, so long as you let the people know it's strictly entertainment, not based on anything. No, I feel like there are some tours you can take that are very factual accounting of the history of that area, and other times you're just kind of like, whoa, where did that come from?
I guess the most famous ghost spotting destination in Louisiana is the Myrtles Plantation.
Yeah, well, based on the fact that they have so many different ghosts of so many different ages. They have children, they have adults, They have ghosts of all. One was a caretaker on the grounds. One, as I said before, they were the two daughters of one of the plantation owners. And then the big one up there is Chloe, the slave.
So you say kind of factually that they have upstairs, downstairs, and form. And so do you think there really are those ghosts there?
I've been there, and there's sometimes little, nothing huge, but little things happen where you just have to kind of question, is that what I saw? Is that what I heard? Is that what I was smelling? And so, you know, ghosts are like clouds. They appear in the night sky. They pass through. You can't capture them per se. So you either just accept or reject the validity of an oft-told tale. Because sometimes there's not really anything that you can use to say that definitely happened. And I know very few people who have actually been able to take a photograph of a ghost, except for up at the Myrtles, where they do put on display a photograph that the owner took. She took it for insurance purposes to document how close the buildings were to each other. And when the photograph was developed, you see a figure of a woman and you can see the boards of the house through her, and they've measured it and everything balances, like from her shoulders to her head to her legs, that this is pretty good proportion. And again, the owner wasn't taking it to try and capture a ghost. She wasn't even aware that this image was in the photograph until she had it developed and brought it home and put it out on a counter. And one of the people who worked there were like, did you see what's in the picture? And so now they have blown this picture up and it's up there. So if you want to see a ghost, you can go up and look at this picture and make your own judgment.
Okay. Now your home base now is Cape Cod, and from kind of just glancing through, it seems like one advantage you have for ghost stories is you got sea captains and ships. Mm-hmm. What would be a classic Cape Cod ghost story?
A classic Cape Cod ghost story. I actually did a whole separate book on it. It's called Haunted Cape Cods, Sea Captains, Shipwrecks, and Spirits. And so one was actually, I did the Andrea Doria, which sank off of Nantucket. And there have been, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but something like 12 different divers who have gone down to the wreck of the Andrea Doria have died there. Others who have been able to come back have claimed they hear music coming from the Andrea Doria. They say that they have seen like a hand try and come out and reach them. So, you know, one could say when you dive down to a certain depth, it does affect your brain and your perception. Sure. So, you know, how accurate are these tales? I don't know. But it is very interesting when they talk, for example, when they say they could hear music. And when you look into the history of the Andrea Doria, she was shipping accordions to New York. So she had this load of accordions. And the divers that have come back up say that's what it sounded to them, like accordion music they could hear still being played.
Oh. So that'd be a classic. Sounds to me like that, yeah. Seems to me like a sea captain would be a great person to be a ghost. I mean, you kind of like, you know, yes. Like a sea captain and kind of be.
Well, and again, when you connect it up with the, you know, whaling was huge up here between Nantucket and Cape Cod, was the whaling capital of the world. So these sea captains, you know, sailed the Arctic Ocean. They went to Patagonia. They were all over. And there are all these, one would call the whopper of the ghost tales, where they go to spear the whale and they get dragged overboard. And there's this wonderful story about one that was actually pulled inside the jaws of a whale. And when he got in there, what he saw was the devil and a mermaid, and they were playing cards. And so he...
The devil and a mermaid playing cards?
Playing cards inside the mouth of the whale. Okay. And so it gets really good. So, you know, his crew thought, well, he's a goner. He hasn't come back up. And after about a half an hour, he supposedly surfaced. And he told his crew, he said, we can go home now, but I want to come back. And he kept coming back. He kept diving into the water. And finally, the story goes, his wife got so jealous that he was going to see this mermaid in the mouth of a whale, that she had a spear, a harpoon made with a golden tip on it, sort of like the vampire stories, where you have to have the golden spear to kind of kill the vampire. So she had this, she gave it to him. She didn't tell him it had a gold tip on it. And previously, when he had taken his spear and tried to kill this whale, it just bounced off of him. And this particular time, when he used the spear with the gold tip, it penetrated the whale and the whale drowned. And so no more mermaid, no more devil, no more playing cards.
Wow.
So a real whopper of a tale.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a crime in Massachusetts for attempting to murder a mermaid.
Well, mermaid stories are something you can go back into accounts by sailors, sea captains, 200 years, and they talk about seeing mermaids. You know, people say today, oh, it was, some kind of large fish, or maybe it was a whale, so they attribute these tales to different things, but there are a lot of accounts where a sea captain in his log will write about seeing this mermaid.
Oh, okay. And your other topic, Mississippi, what stops in Mississippi?
Well, all over Mississippi, I went from Biloxi all the way up to Tupelo, Mississippi. And what I did is I just got in my car and went on a road trip. And some places I knew in advance that there had been stories being told about these different places. And others I just took a chance or somebody would refer me. I was in Greenland, Mississippi, and the director of the Chamber of Commerce, and they had it in an old armory. And he told me that they have seen the ghost of the old armory and that he would walk like across a hallway. And then he told me to go to Glen Allen, Mississippi, which is this tiny little town, and go and ask for Mike Jones. And then Mike Jones would take me to two haunted mansions. And he did. One of them was interesting in that when we got there, we were met by a reporter from a local television station who heard I was going to see this abandoned mansion. And there was a curtain in the front of the building on the second story. And the window had been broken, I guess, for a long time. And there was a breeze that was blowing everything else all around, the trees and stuff, in one direction from like east to west. And when we looked up at this curtain in the window, it was blowing in the opposite direction, as if a hand had grabbed it and pulled it the other way. And there was three of us, and we all stood down there and went, well, that's interesting. How can that possibly be happening? But it was nice to have two other people there with me to go, yeah, we see it's going in the wrong direction. How is that possible? But it really looked like some unseen hand had grabbed the curtain and pulled it the opposite way that the breeze was going. So I've had little things like that happen that I can't logically explain away.
So when you witness something like that, how do you feel? Does it, for lack of a better term, does it spook you, or do you laugh, or do you, or how do you react to that?
I think depending on the circumstances and who I'm with, sometimes you have to be careful, because some people take this very, very seriously and they don't want it made into a joke. And yeah, so sometimes I'm shocked more than others. But for me, most of the things that have happened have been smaller incidents, and it hasn't been something huge. And the only time it was huge, we were shooting at a plantation. I wasn't there to do a ghost story. And we were interviewing this 93-year-old gentleman who was the owner. And behind him was a window that had been boarded up a vandals or something had taken it off. And so as we were shooting and I was interviewing this gentleman with the window behind him, I looked up and there was a woman in the window and the house was empty. And I was so afraid that my interview was ruined because this woman was in the shot. And I turned to the cameraman and I whispered into the camera mic, "Is she in the shot? Is she in the shot?" And he didn't answer me. So I figured, oh, he must have gone in for a close-up. We're fine. And on the way back to the station, I said, oh, it's a good thing you were on a close-up when that woman stuck her head through the window. And he said to me, I didn't see anything. And so I turned to the audio guy who was standing, there were all three pairs of eyes on this shot. And he was like, you know, I promise you, Ms. Barbara, I didn't see a thing. So when I got back to the station, I queued up the tape. I boosted the camera mic's audio. And we were on a close up, so you couldn't see the window, but you can hear me saying, is she in the shot? Is she in the shot? So clearly I saw something, and I have one guy on this side of me, one guy on this side of me. They didn't see anything. And that bothered me. That bothered me a lot, that I saw one in the window, three pairs of eyes, all looking the same direction. We were all very focused, and they didn't see her. I have no explanation for why I saw a woman in the window. And it was very, very clear. I mean, I could see her hair. I could see her eyes. I could see her from like head to about her waist. And she was only there for maybe about 7 to 10 seconds. So it was short, but it was obvious. And that bothered me. It definitely bothered me that I had witnesses and they claimed they didn't see anything. So I've had different, to answer your question, I've had different reactions depending upon where I am and what's going on.
But it's great. I mean, you've gotten to write about it, and yet something that you can point to with having had an experience.
Yes, yes. And I do get that question a lot when I do book talks. People want to know, you know, and I used to initially, I would take the PBS stance and I would say, very neutral, I'm open to the possibilities. And now people say, you know, do you believe in ghosts or spirits? And I'm like, sure, why not? I mean, I don't see a problem with believing that you can somehow connect with someone who's passed. I don't think it's anything harmful. I think it's comforting. And so I just don't see the problem with it.
But going back to what we were saying, it seems, if that's true, it's more likely that someone, not really in the ancient past, but I mean, I guess there's still the period of time where people can see ghosts from the Civil War. But probably at some point they won't see that anymore.
No, I've been places, McRaven House in Mississippi. When you go on the tour there, one of their ghosts definitely is a Civil War soldier. So people do talk about, and Lloyd Hall, they talk about a Confederate soldier that was killed there at the house. So that's still going on. That hasn't gone away. So stories about ghosts from the Civil War are still surfacing.
But will we see any ghosts? Well, where you are in your area in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Are there any ghosts in the Revolutionary War?
I haven't. I'm trying to think if I've encountered a story from the Revolutionary War. I think the earliest I have gotten is a pirate from 1717. And he, very involved, layered story, but we know he was a real person. They have birth certificates. We know that he was born in Plymouth, England. They know who his mother was. They know when he came to the Cape. We know when he turned pirate. We know when his ship wrecked off the Cape Cod, off the lower Cape. So we know all of that about him. And people today still talk about seeing his spirit or his ghost walking Marconi Beach. So that's as back as far as 1717. So I've got a ghost from 300 years ago.
You've also written a couple of novels, one called The Ghosts Within, and mm-hmm. The other has one of the most intriguing titles I've ever heard, Ashes of Old Lovers.
mm-hmm. They're both, those two are both fiction, complete fiction. And they are, I use both the same title characters in both of these books. And the first one is, it is a ghost story, but it's also about the ghosts that haunt our lives, you know, things that have happened in our past that continue to haunt us. So it's sort of a weaving back and forth between a ghost story at the particular place where the character is, and also the fact that she is haunted by some things from her past. And The Ashes of Old Lovers sort of continues that story, and it's the main character visiting a plantation, of all places, surprise, and what happens there and how she evolves and what is happening to her there. So, yeah, I guess I do write a lot about ghosts. But I also love to write about history. I'm absolutely fascinated with how things from the past influence where we are today and how we are affected by them.
It's fascinating. So it's really a really psychological study in many ways, too.
Yes, 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 definitely, definitely. And I think it is psychological how we either are totally opposed to being able to connect with spirits of another world. Some people, it's a religious thing. Some people, it's harder to get people to talk about ghosts up here on the Cape than it would be, for example, in New Orleans. You know, in New Orleans, ghosts are not, and haunted tales are not limited to Halloween. They're year round. Whereas up here, some people feel perhaps maybe a little embarrassed to be talking about, oh yeah, I might have a ghost. So hasn't been as easy to interview people up here as it has been in Louisiana. There's a more casual acceptance in Louisiana.
Yeah, we're lucky in New Orleans that there's not much that embarrasses here. You know.
Very, very true. I interviewed Father Maestri, a Catholic moral theologian, and he said, here in Louisiana, we're like cultural and religious bag ladies. We take a little of this, we take a little of that, and we carry it around with us, which I thought was just a great description of what we do in Louisiana, because we do seem to take all the bits and pieces from all the different cultural traditions and kind of accept them and incorporate them into our lives.
What places, are there any, like, one or two places in the country that have a reputation for being the most haunted, like a city or a state or?
Well, I think New Orleans has long held on to the reputation as being, you know, the top three. South Carolina, like Charlotte. I've heard places, maybe San Francisco seems to have quite a lot of ghost stories, and that kind of comes and goes.
In New Orleans, Ethan, Charlotte, and San Francisco, I mean, there's similarities. I mean, they're all old cities and classical
cities. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I think any place that has a long history and has a history of different cultures that have been retained and the traditions have been retained, I think you're going to find a lot. And that's what I love. Whenever I go to a new place, my first place I head is wherever the historic district is in the town. That's where I gravitate to immediately, because I want to hear all the stories, whether they're ghost stories or stories of the history. I just love the stories.
What did you think of the movie Ghostbusters?
I think it's fun. I think it was just meant to be a comedy. It was strictly for entertainment value. You know, and then there's the Scooby-Doo thing. And again, I think it's fine. It's fine to have stories just for entertainment value. You know, you don't take them seriously.
But those sort of like creatures that they went after, those weren't ghosts.
No.
I mean, no,
yeah.
We're calling all those things ghosts, you know.
No, some people will go into the whole, it's like when you're asking me about ghost tours. So some ghost tours will stick strictly to the topic of ghosts, and others will throw in a monster or some kind of, you know, they'll throw in Bigfoot, and you're like, wait, Bigfoot in Louisiana? You know, if we're going to do a monster, let's stick to the loup-garou. Let's stick to the traditions of, you know, of the bayous and the swamps. Let's not throw in things from other parts of the country or other. So I have seen a few, there was one ghost tour I saw that was going around in New Orleans, and the tour guide was dressed as a gorilla. And I couldn't quite. I was just like, and you're dressed as a gorilla? Why in New Orleans? Like, so some will kind of veer off in their own little directions.
You know, I was working on an article and in the process, and actually I started off talking about the Rougarou. And then by the end, I discovered that there is a monster in the swamp, a real monster. It's called the alligator.
Yes.
And they're dangerous and they got an evil look. And you know they say there's 2 million alligators in Louisiana.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. I absolutely believe. And you know, but there is an alligator hunting season, correct? I mean, for a while there wasn't. I think there is one now.
Yeah.
And but the loup-garou, I was able to. This was before Katrina interviewed Captain Dupree of Chacahula Tours, which no longer exists. And he took me out to what he called Île Fantôme, an island out in the swamps. And he said that the loup-garou was there and that the pirate Jean Lafitte buried treasure there. And he killed one of his men. So his spirit would guard the treasure. But he's told me, he said he was raised with stories of the loup-garou by his parents, who would use the stories of the loup-garou to say, you know, you have to stay on the right path. If you get off the path, the loup-garou can get you. So he said they kind of used it to try and keep the kids in line. So, but he said it definitely, as he was raised with stories of the loup-garou. He said he tried to teach his children about the loup-garou and they just blew him off. They weren't afraid of the loup-garou at all.
If anybody listening is confused about that word, they understand that it's loup-garou. The loup comes from the French word for wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Cajun werewolf.
Yeah. And I'm not sure, I forget where garou comes from, but it's something wolf, no less. And of course,
yeah.
The wolf throughout history just has a really amazing place in
right.
the religions, everything else. It's really a mystical animal.
Right. Well, when Captain Dupree would refer to him, he would actually say the roux-garou. And that's how he learned to name this swamp monster. So he would say the roux-garou, and he had a very, very thick Cajun accent. And speaking of alligators, when I was interviewing him, he had two twin baby alligators, one under each arm, and he would stroke under their chins. And supposedly, if you stroke under their chins, they will kind of fall asleep. Now, I wouldn't suggest doing it to a 7-foot alligator, but he was doing it to these two baby alligators, and it was fascinating. He would just like rub under their chins, and they just kind of like would collapse. So
well, next time we have you on, we're going to get a couple of alligators, okay? And we'll do it.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Okay.
I'm fine with looking at them from a distance. And they're also, you know, my youngest daughter works at this, she worked at Audubon Zoo. She's now at Denver Zoo. And, you know, she took me behind the scenes. And those alligators move quickly. I mean, they move fast. You think of them being kind of this prehistoric creature. But, boy, when they're hungry, they move on land. So it's not just a matter of, oh, you have to watch out for them in the water. You have to watch out for them on land because they can book it.
They had a kind of a growth type. But they had a classic kill last year, a man on the West Bank walking along the gun by you, and the alligator got him. It was a classic thing when the alligator clutched him and jumped into the water and then did the rolling.
Rolling, yes.
Yeah, to drown them first, okay?
Yes.
And then and this is a guy who lived his whole life in the swamps and knew all this kind of stuff with it, but this got to him. So, okay, well, before I let you go, okay, well, let's get everything straight. Your books, what's that? Are they all out now on the shelves?
They're all out. They're all in either independent bookstores, Barnes & Noble. All of my books are also ebooks. So you can go to Barnes & Noble's, you can go to Amazon, and I have a total of 9 books out right now. And I am working on a 10th book. So yeah, you can just go to any bookstore, give them my name if you don't know the whole title, and they can get the book.
What is your new book about?
The new book actually is about Knobsco Lighthouse, and it was going to be for the History Press, and it was just going to be about the lighthouse. It's like I can't get away from ghosts. So when I went there to interview the people that are now running the lighthouse, one of the lead docent immediately began telling me the story of Wiki, their ghost. I didn't ask about a ghost. And now I've got a ghost I've got to work into this book that I had no intention of doing to start off with at all. But so now I have to meet Wiki.
And where is the lighthouse?
The lighthouse it's in Falmouth, and it's called Knobska Light. It's on a point that sticks out it's pointing towards Nantucket, Vineyard Sound and Nantucket Sound. So it's a route that the whalers used to take all the time when they were coming back into shore. So it was a very active lighthouse. Coast Guard still maintains the lighthouse, but a nonprofit group now manages the tours and the tours of the two keepers' houses that are on the grounds.
Oh, amazing. Well, you're really just turning them out, huh? I mean, yeah.
I love stories. I don't know what to say. I love stories and I love passing on stories.
Yeah, a lot of people would really envy that life of like living on Cape Cod and writing novels.
Mm-hmm. it's phenomenal. What I will admit, I'm not too crazy about the winters because it can be very isolating here in the wintertime. But spring, summer, fall, it's gorgeous here. It's really beautiful. And, you know, every single town on the Cape has got a historic area. So it's perfect.
Yeah.
For anybody who likes to write, it's great.
Okay. So the name is Barbara Silver. Got a ton of books out there. They're in all the bookstores and they're on all the appropriate websites. Barbara, thank you very much. It's been very entertaining, delightful, and informative.
Thank you, as always. I love talking to you. It's been great.
Okay. We'll do it again. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.